On this show, I'm talking with Alice, who runs the only idol group in Japan that is made up of non-Japanese members. We talk about idol culture, the struggles that she's gone through to grow the popularity of her group, and what's the deal with those creepy old fans. Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of the Tokyo Podcast. I'm your host, Anthony Joe. And on today's show, I'm going to be speaking with Alice, who runs an all-gaijin idol group here in Japan. And she's actually the only all-gaijin idol group in Japan. All the other idol groups are made up of Japanese, and she's the only one whose all of her bandmates are foreigners. And the reason why I wanted to talk to Alice was, a few episodes ago, I did a show about my favorite movies that are set in Japan. And on that list, one of the films is a documentary called Tokyo Idols. And I think this is just a fantastic documentary and a really great look into the idol culture here in Japan. And a little bit about kind of who the idols are, who their fans are, and what is it about Japanese society that kind of creates this phenomenon that's quite unique to Japan. Now, if you don't know what idol group is, just go on YouTube and you can actually search for them. I'm sure you'll see like concerts and whatnot. And what you'll find is a bunch of teenage girls dancing on stage and what looks like their dads dancing in the audience. And at first, when you first look at that, you're like, that's kind of creepy and odd. Which was my thought exactly. I remember I talked about this on the show. The first time I saw idol group, I was in Hokkaido and I was filming for the snow festival and I saw a group on stage. So I started filming them. And then when I turned the camera around to look at the audience, I thought, what? What are their dads doing here? It's like, there's no fans or anything. But it wasn't until much later when I watched this documentary, I kind of learned that most of the idol fans are these kind of like middle-aged guys. And this documentary does a really good job of kind of going into who these people are and why they are such fans of the idols and how that whole culture exists here in Japan. So it's a documentary that I highly recommend. And for me, I wanted to find out what it's like being on the other side of the stage. What is it like from the idol's perspective and having this kind of fan base? And also, what is the business like behind the idol groups? Like, what do they have to do to grow their business and become, you know, super famous in Japan, and what that whole world is like?
Idols in Japan are mostly, it's a group of either boys or girls, and they sing and dance on stage. And the difference between them and normal artists is that rather than selling their music, they're kind of selling the brand's image, and they're kind of selling themselves, I suppose, because most of their sales come from like handshake events and selling pictures of themselves, that kind of stuff. So the music actually is surprisingly not as important compared to other musical artists.
Ah, okay, interesting. So it's like, it's kind of like, I guess, like the boy bands that were popular like in the, what, late 90s, early 2000s?
Yes, exactly.
Is that when boy bands were? I don't remember, but, you know, like, yeah, like, I think, like, if you go, like, during that era, I guess there was a lot of criticism for those boy bands because they were more performers than, say, musical artists, I would say.
Mm.
Yeah. And so I guess idols is kind of the same thing. It's like, it's kind of a performance and they're selling that performance rather than the actual music.
Yes, exactly.
Okay. Yeah, because you can definitely look at like bands from the 60s and 70s and whatnot, like Led Zeppelin or AC/DC or these bands, and these guys definitely could not sell their image, right? So they have to sell their music, right? So
yeah, pretty much that.
Like, look at Keith Richards. That guy couldn't sell anything based on his looks, but he can certainly sell based on his music, right? So, so idols are huge in Japan. They're a massive industry. They have these shows on TV, I guess, where they do this voting system and all that. Can you kind of explain to the audience a little bit kind of the hierarchy? Because as I understand it, there's kind of like a hierarchy kind of within groups and within Japan itself, and that some of the groups kind of move up and down in this kind of world?
Yeah, I mean, there's the most popular groups, and they're like on TV all the time. I mean, you've got like the 48 family, you've got the 46 groups, and then you've got like the Hello Project groups, which have been around for absolutely ages. And they're kind of like untouchable in the industry. Like, there's no way that you're going to really get past them. And then also, every year, there's Tokyo Idol Festival, which generally happens in Odaiba in the summer. And groups that have like a fixed appearance at that every year, they're kind of like the next like upcoming groups. So, that's probably like the second most famous like types if you're talking about the hierarchy. And then you've got groups like my group who are kind of generally not that well known. They're not going to be at massive idol festivals, but they perform these things called taiban, where a lot of different small idol groups come together and perform at a small live house, like around Tokyo, around anywhere really. So those are the general kind of stages in which idol groups kind of come in, like the super famous ones. And then there's the kind of like next door idols like us.
In this documentary called Tokyo Idols, and if you haven't seen it, by the way, I really recommend checking it out. It's on Netflix.
Mm-hmm.
It's really, really well. I thought it was really, really well done. They follow this one girl who's like, I think she's just kind of by herself. I don't know. She doesn't seem to be in any kind of band or anything by herself, but she kind of mentioned that she can move up in the rankings with the support of her fans by buying CDs and going to handshake events. How does that all work? Like, how do the fans help you guys move up and get more exposure?
So in absolutely every way, actually, the fans are the most important part of it. So if you talk about like the kind of activities we have, most of the money that we're going to be making is from like events, like concerts, that kind of stuff. So first of all, if the fans come to the concerts, like generally when they apply for a ticket, they have to say which idol that they're coming to see. So if a lot of fans are coming to see your group, it means that the event organizers are going to see like real potential in your group, and they'll ask you to come to more like performances and more concerts. Therefore, you're going to get more exposure. And then also if they buy checky, which are like the small pictures that you can decorate and then you give them to them like as a memento for meeting you, they buy checky, if they have like handshakes and stuff, if they buy CDs, then obviously that money is going to come into you or come into the company if you're into a company. And then if they have more money, then they can promote you more, they can give you better costumes, they can get you better songs, that kind of stuff. Like, it's really all to do with the fans.
Right. Wow, that's interesting. That's interesting that you said that the fans choose when they buy the ticket, like who they're coming to see. I guess that allows like the concert promoter to then kind of see which groups are more popular than others, right?
Yes, exactly. And also, if there's a massive crowd for one group, the people who are there for other groups, they're going to be like, oh, what's happening over there? And then it's kind of easy for you to kind of steal other fans, other groups' fans.
So, yeah, I didn't realize actually how important the fans are, because they really can kind of make or break your success in a way, can't they? It's not
absolutely
just like in the old days with just buy your music. It's more than that, right? They have to kind of engage with you almost through these events and going to concerts and those kind of things.
Yeah, and also because we have like the internet at the moment, especially on Twitter, if the fans are, because all the fans are connected generally because they're at the same events. So if they're tweeting about you, if they're sharing pictures of you, if they're sharing videos of your performance, like they're really doing like promotion for you on Twitter.
Right, right. Well, that's interesting, huh? It's kind of fascinating that whole industry has kind of evolved to figure out this, like how to monetize that engagement with the fans in a way. Because, you know, like I've been working in Japan for 7 years, and I've said this many times on my show, is that many Japanese companies are just utterly clueless about how the internet works and how to use it and all that. But it's just fascinating to me that this one industry has actually just really figured out the best way to monetize the fans and use the power of the internet to kind of grow that monetization model. That's amazing. They should teach the rest of Japan how to do that.
Yeah, maybe.
So can you tell us a little bit of background about yourself? Is that how did you get into this business and how did you become an idol?
Okay, so I've always been an idol fan for about 12 years now. And then when I moved to Japan, I actually wanted to go into the industry immediately, but I had all of these doubts about myself. And also I didn't want to do it by myself. I wanted a group. So I've been in Japan for 6 years now. And all of those 6 years, I've wanted to perform. So, finally, about 2 years ago, I was like, you know what? Why am I waiting? I want to perform. So I started applying for like talent agencies, like mostly Japanese agencies as well. And then last year, I finally found an agency that wanted foreigners specifically to do like otaku related stuff, like idol stuff, cosplay stuff. So when I went into that company, I saw I met a couple of other girls who wanted to do the same thing, but for some reason, the company itself, they really wanted to do cosplay and not idol stuff. So after kind of having my time wasted for half a year, me and the girls that I met at that company were like, okay, how about we just make our own group and we do it by ourselves? So I ended up making My Dorimi, this little group of three girls, me, one French girl and one Mexican girl. And at the moment, we're the only active foreigners-only group in Tokyo. And it was surprisingly easy to get into. Like, I thought it would be a lot more difficult. But all I had to do was make a Twitter, get some pictures. And then it took a lot of research, actually, to find the events organizers, who's making these companies, who's making the concerts, who's making these events in Taiwan, and then just messaging them and saying, hi, can my group perform at your event, please? And that's pretty much how I got into it. Like, it's a lot less difficult to get into than I thought it would be.
Well, yeah, that's interesting. When you originally started to look into it and then talking to agencies and whatnot, was that challenging for you? Because I imagine back then there was, like you said, you're the only active foreign group, right? So if you're showing up at some of these talent agencies and they obviously see that you're a foreigner, were they accepting or were they like, no chance or what?
It really depends on the agency. So a lot of them, like especially the big ones, they're going to look at you and it's not really about what you want to do or what you're going to this company to do. It's what they think that they can make money off of you for. So if I want to be an idol, but they think I'm going to be better as a talent or like a gravure model, then you can't really argue with them about that because obviously they're used to looking at people and seeing how can I monetize this person. So it's difficult in a way because if you don't fit their image of what they think an idol is, and foreigners are already out of that category, sadly, it's difficult. And also the fact that all of us are like over 20 already, they prefer them to be a lot younger. So everyone was pretty skeptical, like especially Japanese agencies, like normal agencies, they don't want to hear it mostly. They're like, no, I don't think you're going to be good at this. I think you'll be better at this. And I mean, if you get told that, there's no really any options for you. You have to kind of leave that on its own. So honestly, it was better doing it by myself. Even now, messaging these events organizers, people who are organizing the like group concerts and stuff, a lot of them want us to be there as like a gimmick instead of serious working idols. They're like, oh, it'll be interesting to have some guys in. Let's put them in the lineup. But then they'll give us like a really terrible time slot, like the opening time, even though we're actually senpai groups of like a lot of the groups who are there. Like we have more fans and following than them, but they still give us like a bad slot because they're like, throw the gaijin on first.
Right.
So there's still a little bit of difficulty there. But in terms of agencies, like, it's kind of a dead end.
How did you feel about that? Because like if you're going in and you want to be an idol and they're telling you, well, the only way you're going to work with us is if you do this cosplay or something like that. How did that make you feel?
It was incredibly frustrating. Like most of last year, actually, it was just me getting my time wasted by different agencies. But you can't be angry about it because it's their job to make money off of you. If they're going to invest in you, then they're going to want to have some kind of profit off you. And if they think that you're not going to sell, then you can't really argue with that. But it's so frustrating because obviously I want to do this specifically. And that's the reason why I'm speaking to them in the first place. And they're like, probably not. So it was a bad time.
Yeah, I guess that's one of the challenges of doing business in Japan, though, isn't it? Is that, yeah, you can understand it's their job to make money. And, you know, it sounds bad to say it, but in a sense, you are a product. And so, like, they're going to invest in this product. So they need to see a return on investment. But I think one of the challenges with Japan is that they are very hesitant to take any kind of risk.
Yes, and especially since no foreign idols have really made it up until now either.
Right.
So the big agencies, they're really not going to look twice at you.
Right, so then they're just looking for the same cookie cutter thing that they've been doing for decades. And because don't fit that, then they just don't even give you that consideration.
Yeah, I mean, foreign cosplayers have really exploded onto the market and you can make a lot of money off of them, especially if they're doing kind of like, you know, like sexy cosplay, that kind of stuff. But
yeah.
Foreign idols, no one's actually made it big so far, ever.
Yeah, right? You're going to be the first, right?
Yeah, of course.
All because of you came on my Tokyo podcast and my 35 listeners.
Oh, yeah. Hi, 35 listeners. What's up? Support my daughter and me.
Just kidding. We actually have a little bit more than 35, but
I
not
can
a lot
yeah,
more.
Yeah,
you know what's interesting? A little bit of a side topic, but I remember a long time ago, I read this article about Starbucks when they came into Japan. And they hired this Japanese local consulting company to do a research on the Japanese market. And the report came back and they said that you will absolutely fail if you go into the Japanese market. Because one, Japanese people like to smoke inside their, you know, restaurant, the coffee shops, and Starbucks doesn't allow smoking. And there's a whole kisetan, you know, culture here. And so like they're never going to switch and all that. And so like this whole report prepared by this Japanese company said you will absolutely fail if you come into Starbucks. And luckily for Starbucks, they said, yeah, screw that idea. We're going into Japan. They came into Japan and it became like a huge market for them. So I think that's, I always look at that as a good demonstration of like, you know, sometimes the experts can be wrong.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, like you have to take risks and you have to put a foot forward if you want to get anywhere.
Right. Right. So you explain a bit, a little bit actually to me, just because I'm curious myself, is like, how do these cosplay people make money? Because they're not performing on stage, are they?
They get a lot of money for appearing at events. Like Tokyo Game Show, like the anime conventions, if they're working in a booth and they're like promoting something.
Right,
also, there are like satsuekai. So a lot of people will gather at one location, lots of cameramen and lots of cosplayers, and they kind of rotate in the cameramen, pay to take photos of the cosplayers themselves. And then also like they sell like photo sets and videos. And I mean, especially if they're doing like kind of sexy cosplay, they are making money.
Right. Okay. Yeah. I remember I did some work with a cosplayer in the Philippines named Elodia. Have you heard of her?
Oh, she's super. Yeah. She's gigantic. Yeah. She's probably one of the biggest ever.
And, I can always just call her Elodia because most people know Elodia, and also because I can't really pronounce her last name properly. So
go saying she has something on the
I know it starts with a G, but the good thing is Elodia is so huge. If I just say Elodia, like 99% of people know who she is, you know? So, but I remember one of the things she told me that was kind of funny is she was traveling back and forth between the Philippines and Japan for work at the time. And she told me that when she's in Japan, she would play video games online with her sister in the Philippines. And then she would charge her fans to join in and watch her and her sister play video games.
That's lucrative. Yeah, big business now.
Yeah, and I thought that's just brilliant because she's not having to interact with them. She's just playing video games with her sister because she wants to stay connected to her family. And then all these fans are like locking in just to watch her play video games with her sister.
Yeah, it's really, I mean, especially with like Twitch streaming at the moment as well. Like it's gigantic now. I think it's great.
I was like, oh my God, if I could find a group of people to watch me play video games, that'd be fantastic. If anyone wants to pay me to watch me watch Netflix, like, you know, contact me. And if I can get people to watch me do this podcast, maybe not.
Maybe one day, like...
Yeah, actually, look at what happened with Joe Rogan. He got $100 million for his podcast.
Seriously, damn, follow your dreams.
Yeah, Spotify just bought the Joe Rogan podcast and they said they rumored to be $100 million that they paid for it. So pretty good for Mr. Rogan over there. So, but that's really interesting. So you had this dream and you, did you come to Japan to pursue this in specifically or did you come to Japan for some other reasons?
I didn't really have a full reason to come to Japan. I just kind of like turned up one day. I mean, I was always interested in it, but no, I didn't move to Japan specifically to do idol stuff.
And then at what point did you decide to get into the idol stuff?
Very, very seriously, I decided probably December of last year. What year was that? 2018 December. Literally December 31st was when I sent off an application to a Japanese agency that were famous for idol stuff.
Oh, okay. So it's quite recent actually then.
Yeah, I've always wanted to, but I had no real confidence in myself, so it kind of held myself back.
So what changed on December 31st?
It was New Year, and I was like, wow, I've wasted another year of my life. What am I going to do next year? How can I make next year a year that I'm going to be proud of? Especially since, like, being a female, your value kind of decreases over time. So being like I'm 26 now, so I think I was 25, so I was like, already in my late 20s, what can I do? So December 31st, literally midnight, I was like, right, 2019, I'm going to actually do things. I'm going to do the stuff that I want to do, and I sent off my applications.
You know, those feminists that listen to this are just heads are exploding right now by you saying like women's value decreases at the ripe old age of 26, you know, like, but
I mean, I don't want to say it out loud, but I mean, it sucks, but it's true. Like, it's more difficult to get jobs, especially when our product is ourselves and our looks and our youth and our femininity. Like, it's going to go down, and that's just a fact. Sorry,
yeah,
everyone.
Actually, you know what? That's true. Because I have a friend of mine who worked as a model here in Japan for a number of years. And mm-hmm. she's a professional model. She works as like what you call like not a catalog model. That's kind of an insulting term. But what did she call it? Like print model?
Print?
I can't remember. Yeah, maybe print model. Like she wasn't like on the runway, the fashion runway. But like if you open a magazine and you see someone holding like an SD card or a camera or something like that, right? Like she was that. And she was like in an IKEA commercial here. She was in like a shampoo commercial here. So she was a model like this. And it was interesting. I won't embarrass her by telling her age, but she was like, you know, past her 30s, say between the age of 30 and 40. But what was interesting to me, actually, I never even thought about it, was the fact that, yeah, she was her product. Her appearance was her product. So she was very aware that as her product, so to speak, changes with age and time, the opportunities that would be available to her would also change. And so she had to make sure that her product, which is her appearance, stayed marketable. So I remember she'd like brush her teeth like 10 times a day and have all sorts of skin cream. And she like did all kinds of things just to make sure that she was as marketable as possible. And I know there's like some feminists and some women look at that and go, that's terrible. But you really think about it from a business standpoint, it makes sense. If she makes money from her appearance, And it only makes sense that she tries to maximize that for as long as possible. And unfortunately, like you said, those opportunities do diminish as women get older, especially in Japan, right?
Yeah. So there's kind of like a little no man's land in like your late 20s to early 30s when you're not as young as they want you to be for other commercials, but you're also not as old as they want you to be for like the ones geared to like more mature ladies.
Right, right.
But yeah, if you're the product, then you have to market yourself.
Right. So that's interesting. So you made this decision December last year. You're like, I'm, you know, at the ripe old age of, what are you, 26?
I was 25 at the time.
Like, good Lord, I'm 47. You sound like a child, you know, like that just sounds so young. I wish I made that decision when I was 26. But I mean, hell, it's a great decision to make when you're a young age, you know. When I was 26, I was like, huh, I wonder if I can go drinking this weekend. But then what were some of the first steps that you decided to do to make sure that you kind of took action and you weren't like 6 months later, like, oh crap, I haven't done anything.
Don't think about things basically. Like if I see like an agency that's recruiting, like on Instagram stories recently, they're really like putting out feelers on Instagram stories. Like the ad will come up like, oh, this agency is recruiting for talents at the moment. Like just look at it and apply for it immediately. Don't think, oh, I'll do it tomorrow or I'll wait till I have like better pictures and stuff. Like just send it off. Just do it. And then when it comes through, just go along with it, I suppose. Like that's probably the biggest thing that I did. Like stop
just
thinking so
action,
much and doubting myself.
So then let me ask you a question though, because I'm sure this has probably happened to a lot of people. I can almost guarantee it's going to happen again to you probably in the course of your life, is that you decide to take action, you're taking action, you're like fantastic, but then you're getting all these kind of doors slammed in your face, so to speak, right? Because you're like, hey, I want to be an idol. They're like, no, cosplay, no idol. And you're like, what's going on? How did that make you feel, kind of suddenly like thinking like, whoa, this is turning out a little bit differently than I thought?
It was so frustrating because obviously like everything in your life, if it was just based on your own hard work, it would be so much easier.
Yeah.
But that's, you know, that's not the fact of the matter. Everything is based on other people. So you're waiting for other people to get back to you.
Right.
You're trying to convince other people to give you their time. Like if you could do everything just by not giving up and just trying really hard, everything in life would be so much more simple. But it was just so frustrating, and even more frustrating because like I said earlier, you can't really get angry at these people because they're trained to look for what they can make money off of out of you.
Right. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, that's a good point you made, actually. Yeah, if life was just based on your own hard work, everyone would be millionaires, you know.
Absolutely. Like you say that, you know, all you have to do is grind and, you know, do your best, but there's so many other factors and a lot of it just based off other people.
Yeah, actually, that's a really great point. Especially if you're a young entrepreneur and you're reading all this crap on the internet, like, you know, just grind it out and just hustle and sleep when you're dead and all this kind of stuff. You know, yeah. Rise or grind. Don't forget the fact that, you know, a lot of your success is going to come on not who you know, but who knows you. And why do they want to talk to you? What are you going to do for them? So really keep that in mind.
And not everyone's going to be on your time as well, right? Because you can be trying your best and going full speed ahead, but someone else can be like, I'll get back to you like next month, maybe.
Especially in Japan. So then you started to, what made you then decide like, okay, forget it, I'm going to do my own thing?
Because no one was listening to me.
But you never thought about giving up, eh? You never thought like, okay, I gave it a shot, I'll go back to English teaching or whatever you're doing. Like, you never had that thought?
Actually, last year I applied for one gigantic agency, and after they actually wanted to accept me, but not for what I specifically wanted. They didn't say specifically that they wanted me to do this thing that I really didn't want to do, but they kind of very strongly hinted at it. So I declined them, and I was super upset about that for a good month or so. And then a couple of other things happened. I applied for some day jobs in kind of similar, you know, like idol cafes, like performance cafes, concept cafes, and they kind of turned me down as well. So I was really, really disheartened for probably like a month or two. And I was like, okay, I'm going to apply for one more agency. And if that doesn't work out, then I guess that it wasn't meant to be. And I really did consider like, you know, maybe it's just, maybe they're right. Maybe I can't do it. But then the other agency messed me around so much that I ended up doing everything I wanted to do out of spite.
Oh, really? Spite is such a great motivator.
Honestly.
Like, screw you. I'm going to do it myself.
Do it anyway.
So the last agency you applied at kind of screwed you over, and that's what prompted you to go out on your own?
Yeah, pretty much. I was like, wow, I'm really wasting my time and they're wasting my time. Why do I have to wait for them to do everything when I could probably do it myself?
That's interesting, because like I said, that's not like the typical Hollywood story, right? The Hollywood story would be like the last one I applied to accepted me, and then it led to like, you know, happy trails. But for you, it's like even they said no, so you're like, okay, forget you guys.
I mean, they accepted me, but they were a waste of time. So here we are. But I mean, I'm doing everything on my own, and, you know, I broke into the industry. But like, there are so many things that would be better if I had an agency or at least a manager.
Right. So then, but then you decided to start on your own. And how did you form this band with these other girls?
It was pretty simple. I was like, hey, guys, do you want to start an idol group? They were like, yeah.
And then what did you do? You started contacting the different promoters who are having concerts and whatnot?
Yes, pretty much. So first of all, we needed professional photos taken. So we went to a studio and hired a cameraman and got them to take like some good photos of us. And then I started up the Twitter. And I mean, I already have that many followers on Twitter already, but I shared it on my Twitter. So all of like my friends kind of like shared it for me as well, which is really nice of them. And through that, and a lot of extensive research into the market, like what are other idol groups that started around about the same time as us? How big is their fan base? So we can use that as like a basis to what we should be aspiring to. Which events are they allowed to go to with only 100 followers on Twitter? Which events are they performing at? Who are the kind of people who are following them? Which events pages are following them? So I just went like on a following spree. I would follow all these different idols, all of their management agencies. I would follow events promoters, events organizers, like record labels, like Twitters that are there for promoting and advertising different groups and stuff like that. So I followed all of them. And then when I properly uploaded pictures of like our practices so people can see that, yes, we can sing and dance, we're not just, you know, doing nothing. And then I uploaded like a lot of pictures, then I started getting quite a lot of interest. And because I put the business Gmail up in the Twitter as well, I actually got more interest from events organizers than I put out. Like, they sent me a lot more requests than I sent to other people.
No kidding. Wow, that's fantastic. Huh.
It was really surprising because I really thought I'd have to go begging to them, like, please let me perform, please. Right. But like, they were like, hey, do you want to perform at our event? And we were like, yes.
You should have been like, yeah, let me check my schedule. Let's see if I talk to you before. I remember your no, forget you. Has there been other cases of Japanese idol groups who've done the same thing, who've been kind of started grassroots on their own and then gotten so big that an agency brought them in?
I don't know about if an agency brought them in, but there's actually a couple of groups that I researched to begin with who were also independent, completely like self-produced idols. One of them is called We Mukashi Banashi, and they are huge now. And they started completely on their own, and they were completely like self-financed as well. Like they would go to work like on the weekends and save their money to like pay for dance studios and like pay people to write them songs and stuff. And now they're like really mainstream and they're still doing it all on their own. They haven't got like a proper manager or anything. So there are quite a lot of Japanese groups doing it as well.
Wow, that's pretty cool. So there is a precedent there. So you just have to, basically, it's kind of back on you again, right? You just have to kind of grind it out, put in the work, yeah. And then hopefully doors will open up for you guys.
Hopefully, because I mean, it really depends on your members as well, because obviously if you're in a financially stable position, then you can pay for outfits, you can pay for studios to practice in, you can pay for transport, you can afford to take, because I work mostly nights and I work mostly weekends. So if I have to go to a concert, then I have to take a day off. Whereas if I was like an English teacher or something, I probably would have weekends free. But it means that I actually lose money through it. So the fact that I'm in a financially stable position at the moment is really paramount to how the idol group is going at the moment. If I was probably in a more difficult situation, I don't think I would be able to do it as easy. So it is based on your own hard work, but there really have to be, like, the stars have to align, basically.
Right, yeah. And then what have you done to grow your fan base? Because I guess that's the really key thing, right? Like, the larger your fan base is, the more clout you have, basically, in this yes. industry, right? And the more the agencies will kind of pay attention to you, and the concert promoters and all that will pay attention to you. So what have you guys done to grow your fan base?
So it's mostly all online. So first of all, there was Twitter. So I, to grow the fan base on Twitter, I would like follow other people and like other people, and then basically just make sure that people are retweeting videos of us performing, because I mean, people can be like, oh, it's a foreign idol group. That's kind of interesting. But you're not going to keep their interest if they don't see that you're actually trying and working hard. So it's taking a lot of videos, taking a lot of photos, making sure that people see us live, even if they can't come to see us live. So the biggest thing is going to these events and making sure that you are seen. So the more events you go to, generally, more people are going to know about you. And then you can also kind of steal other groups' fans as well.
Right.
That's the biggest thing. You have to be performing, you have to be performing regularly. And then for people who are online, then you have to put the videos of these performances up so they can see what you're doing. Then there's Showroom. So it's like a live streaming service, like where girls and boys will kind of sit in front of their phone and talk to people, and or people all over Japan can be coming and watching your stream and they can talk to you, so you can promote there as well. Like they'll just come in and be like, oh, hey, I've never heard of you, and you can tell them, hi, I'm part of an idol group in Tokyo, we do this, and then they'll come from Showroom, they'll follow you on Twitter, maybe they'll come and see you one day. So there's a lot of different ways we can do it, but obviously now because of the crisis, like because of the pandemic, we can't actually do any performances. So now everything is online. We started up a YouTube channel so we can kind of interact more with our fans overseas. And other than that, it's Twitter, YouTube, Showroom, and then actual performances. One of the girls in my group was talking about like doing street performances, but I don't want to. So it's an idea, but I prefer not to.
Yeah, it's interesting that Twitter is such a huge platform for you guys. I would have thought maybe like YouTube or Instagram would be bigger, but I guess Twitter is pretty big in Japan, so.
Otaku don't use Instagram.
Oh, no, they don't? Oh, really?
No, otaku is used, I mean, like anime otaku, idol otaku, it's all Twitter. Like, no one really uses Instagram.
Speaking of the otaku, how do you... I promise you, none of your fans are listening to this show, so you can be totally honest. Like, I'd be shocked if any of them are. But what are kind of your thoughts on... let's say like the age demographic of some of these fans. I don't know who your fans are. I'm sure your fans are fantastic, but you know, some of these groups that I've seen in this documentary, a lot of the fans are, you know, older guys. What are your thoughts on that?
I mean, obviously my group, we're all over age. We're all, you know, like adults, so we're not too bothered about it. But there was one event that we went to, and, there was two other groups performing and one soloist, and they were like elementary schoolers, like really young, like they were 10 and 12 years old. And they had a massive fan base, and all of these kind of like middle-aged men came out with these gigantic cameras to take pictures of them on stage and that kind of stuff. And they came with their mother. I think their mother was probably their manager. And I really wish I talked to the mother to see what she thought about it, because if that was my daughter, I would absolutely not, if that was my daughter. So I don't really have very, very, very strong feelings towards it, because obviously I haven't talked to these people. I don't know exactly what they're getting out of watching these little girls on stage, because me watching them, I love watching cute girls, first of all. And then I love watching cute girls like be happy and be energetic and chase their dreams, because, you know, like they're not that good. And that's a good thing, because they're trying so hard, even though they can't really sing and they're out of breath and stuff, they're having a good time. And it makes me want to do my best as well, because look at these cute girls. They're trying to, they're doing all these things. They're chasing their dreams. I need to work hard as well. So that's how what I get out of it. So maybe some of them feel the kind of same way. Maybe it's like recapturing their lost youth, and, you know, like it's refreshing to watch. You know, like it's refreshing to watch people chase their dreams. It's refreshing to watch people doing their best. So maybe it's something to do with that. But like at the same time, there is definitely an underlying
creepiness,
sexualization. yeah, creepiness. I'll say it. Like there's definitely an underlying creepiness. So
you know what
definitely
the thing is?
A problem.
This documentary. I remember when I saw that. I actually watched it on an airplane. I can't remember where I was flying, but it was on. It was like one of the options on the airplane. And I thought, oh, this would be kind of fun. I thought it would be really cringy and like kind of these weirdo otaku and all that. I thought, yeah, it'd be kind of fun to watch this. I'm a huge fan of documentary films. So I thought, yeah, this would be like a cringe fest. That'd be fun to waste time on this airplane. But actually, I was just really surprised at how well the documentary was made. And the thing that surprised me a lot was there's a one section where they follow this one idol. Her name, I think she, her stage name is Rio or something like that. But she has this fan base, and they interview like the head of her fan base, this like Japanese salaryman guy, you know. And he said basically kind of exactly what you're saying. He said he kind of almost regretted taking that salaryman job straight out of university. Because he said his company provided him a very comfortable but unexciting life. And when he was young, he wanted to be like an explorer and go travel around the world. But he took the easy option, which was the company option. And he felt like, I think, what did he say? Like, he was like, yeah, like an uninteresting life or something like that. Like safe and comfortable, but devoid of any excitement or anything like that. And then so what he saw in these idols is exactly what you're saying, is like they're singing about reaching their goals and accomplishing their dreams and like pushing forward and all that, which if you think about in Japan is actually a rare mindset to begin with, right? Like
yeah,
it's not
definitely.
A common mentality even in Japan. So these young girls that are talking, singing about their dreams and their goals and their aspirations. Meanwhile, salaryman Sato, he's given all that up years ago. So for him to help this idol by buying her CDs and going to these events and all that was more about helping her accomplish her goals rather than him being like a creepy pervert and just, you know, being a weirdo. And so that really surprised me in the documentary. I thought all these guys are just creepy weirdos. But the fact that I can understand. And actually, the thing is, he quit his job and then became like the head of her fan base. And that gave him a sense of purpose, because the more he could help her succeed, the more he felt better about himself. So,
I mean, I think it's so important that you said that, because I'm not saying that these people have given up on their dreams, but if they're watching someone else working so hard to like make their dreams come true, and supporting that person makes you feel like you're part of something bigger than yourself.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. So that aspect of it, I thought was really great. Now, keeping in mind, there are certainly no doubt a creepy factor to some. Not all the fans, I think, are like that, right? So,
No.
Even in the documentary, there's some few fans are like, yeah, this guy's a little bit weird.
There are a few. Actually, in the Chikaidoru kind of scene, there are some people who are there literally not even to see the idols. They just want to have a good time and go crazy, because people don't really judge, because we really got all sorts. Like, people who are like normal salarymen during the day, they'll come to a Chikaidoru like concert and they will go insane. Like they'll be screaming, they'll be crying, they'll be sweating everywhere. And it's so good, like a kind of release, like a kind of escape from like a really strict society. So a lot of people will come because they know that we're not going to judge them, because we really get some absolute weirdos as well. And that's fine, because we're all a family.
Yeah, that's actually a really good point. I think that may be something that a lot of like non-Japanese don't really understand. Like in preparation for this interview, I was kind of reading some reviews of that Tokyo Idol documentary. And, you know, a lot of these Western journalists, I don't think they quite understand the stress mm-hmm. and pressure that a lot of these Japanese are under, and that they have almost no release available to them. And so, yeah, to go to this kind of event where no one's going to judge them, they can go completely bonkers, they can do whatever they want. I mean, that's just human nature that you need some kind of outlet like that.
Yeah, definitely. Like some people, we have people, like they come and they really scream. And it's like, are you even here to see the idols or do you just come here to scream? And it doesn't matter if they come here to scream. Like, it's fine. Like, I mean, it's honestly fun to watch. Like, it's really, I think it's a good emotional outlet for them because they know that we're not going to be looking at them with judging eyes.
Yeah. And I think like the old guys who like the elementary, like the young kids and all that, my feeling is that, yeah, once again, like some of them are super creepy perverts, but I think some of them are honestly just like grandparents looking at their grandkids.
Absolutely. Yeah, I absolutely agree. Some of them see their own children. Yeah. Some of them see like, you know, like she's trying so hard. I just want to support her. And I mean, I'm not going to gloss around it. There are definitely some really disgusting men who are out here sexualizing children. I'm not going to try and excuse that because that's just the fact of the matter. Like there are definitely some people like that. But I mean, it's bigger than that. There are people who feel like they're supporting somebody. There are people who feel like they're just watching their grandchildren performing at like a school dance recital or something like that. And there are people who come to escape other things. Like, there's really all sorts.
How do you feel when you go to these kind of handshaking events and you're actually interacting with the fans like one-on-one? Because when you're on stage and they're in the audience, there's a bit of a disconnect, right? They're like, they're not an individual. They're like a one big group, right? But when you're like, you know, one-on-one with them, how does that kind of change things for you?
I don't know, because actually when I'm on stage, I don't see them as a big group because I'm trying to make eye contact with everybody specifically.
Oh, really? Oh, wow. Okay.
I don't really see them as like a hive mind. So when I'm on stage, like I'm trying to see if I can kind of convert this person standing over by the wall. So I'm like, okay, well, after the show, there's the merchandise selling. So it's generally about 2 hours after the show where you're going to stand at a table and try and sell your merchandise and also do handshakes, that kind of stuff. So when I get off the stage, I'm looking for people that I saw when I was on stage. I'm like, where is he? Is he going to come over? Can I talk to him? And, you know, like
okay. The other girls. And the...
It's fun, though. It really is fun. Like, you can talk to them. You can kind of get a feel of their personality, like what they're looking for. Like, how can I get this person to support me? How can I make this person, like, kind of come out of their shell a little bit more if they were shy? Like, for the next performance, can they come and see me specifically? Can they say that they came to see my Doremi rather than another group?
Right.
So it's really nice to actually talk to them and see what kind of people they are. And then they follow you on Twitter and they start like replying to your stuff. Like, it's really, really cool. And then when we take photos together, they always have like a specific pose that they want you to do in the photos. And I think that's kind of telling of personality as well.
Oh, yeah. Like what, like the cat nyan-nyan pose or something like that?
Yeah, like that. Or like if they want you to make a heart by yourself or if they want you to make a heart with them.
Oh, interesting. Huh.
Like that kind of stuff. Like, I mean, they're definitely different because you'll see them, like during the live, they'll be screaming, they'll be like jumping around. But then afterwards, they're like really normal and they'll just talk to you like about your favorite food since you've come to Japan, that kind of stuff.
Right. Right. Wow. Interesting. Are you ever worried at all that some of these guys might kind of misinterpret your actions to be a little bit more than what's implied? Like you said, you're trying to like make eye contact with these guys and chat them up and whatnot. Like I can see some of these guys thinking like, yeah, she really likes me.
Yeah, I can see that maybe happening in the future. It hasn't happened so far and I haven't thought about it that much, but I mean, there have been quite a lot of instances where I've heard other idols in the dressing room backstage talking about fans like that.
Right.
But I don't know, because I find it really difficult to imagine them seeing me as a female, like seeing me as an actual woman rather than seeing me as like a commodity.
The fans seeing you as a woman?
I just don't imagine them seeing me as an attainable object. I think they just kind of see me as like a thing on TV that they're watching.
I see. Do you think it's different for the Japanese idols?
Yeah. I think it's kind of different for us because we're foreign and we're generally the only foreigners there.
Right.
Because they kind of see us a little bit further away. And it does mean that it's difficult for us to like get along with them and make friends with them, that kind of stuff. But right. at the same time, I think it means that they kind of see us as more unattainable because we're just so far away from what they're used to seeing.
Right, right, right. Wow, that's interesting. Yeah, I can see that. A Japanese idol, probably some Japanese guy thinks, like, I'm going to make her my girlfriend type of thing, right? But when they see you guys, because there's that foreignness there, there's a bit of the disconnect, right? You're kind of, they're kind of like, yeah, you're this entertainer. And they don't think that, you know, they probably can't even imagine having a foreign girlfriend. Like, it just doesn't even enter their head. So they'd be like, they can't picture that, which is probably safer for you guys,
I imagine. I mean, I'd like to imagine so. I've never had any propositions. I've never had a guy being creepy with me. And I'd like to think it's because of that. And not just because I'm, like, unattractive or something. But, like, I've heard of it, though. I've heard other girls talking about it. But I've never really thought about it myself.
What about that picture that you posted on Twitter, that dude photographing you at the... at the crosswalk.
With
his old-ass 1990s
phone. Was that a Sony Ericsson? That's the most important takeaway from this, the fact that he had a Sony Ericsson.
Yeah.
And, oh my God, what year is it? What decade is it? Yeah, like...
That's not the fan you want, because you know he can't afford a new phone, so you know he's not going to come to any events or buy any CDs or anything like that. So you're just like, come on, dude. Like, if you can take my photo when you get a better phone. Like, if you have an iPhone 11 Max or something like that, then maybe.
Or, like, ask me to pose for it at least, because, I mean, you know what you look like when you're out walking about. You've got a double chin. You're halfway through blinking. Like, it's no fun for anyone. But, like, that happens to me when I don't have makeup on, when I'm wearing a mask, when I'm wearing, like... my pajamas outside. It's true, because when you have your full makeup, I mean, being male, maybe you don't know, but when you have your full makeup on and you have ascended from the planes of being human to being like a goddess and you just look really, really, really good, generally that's when people don't approach you because you don't seem approachable. But when I look like actual trash, that is when I will have men following me or stalking me for 20 minutes or trying to take photos of me on the street. It's like, why?
Now?
Why? And, like, if this photo ends up on the internet somewhere, like, on one of those blogs, like, I took a picture of a girl today, like, I'm going to be really mad because I look ugly in it. Like, at least let me look cute, please.
That's kind of funny. Well, it's really interesting to learn a little bit about the idol world there. I didn't really know anything about it before, but I'm fascinated to hear kind of the business sense behind it and how you've really kind of applied these goals and metrics to grow the popularity of your band there.
It's hard, especially with the coronavirus.
Yeah, I can imagine.
We can't do anything.
What happens after the virus? Like, where do you guys go from here? What would be kind of the next level for you guys?
So at the moment, because all the events and stuff are cancelled, we've applied for, and we actually have one coming up on the 6th of June, online, no actual fans in the building. It's an online live streamed concert. So we're hoping to expand our fan base around like people who aren't just in Tokyo or people who aren't just in Japan. So we're hoping to expand the kind of knowledge of who we are to people who can sign in online and see us like that. The other girls in my group, they really want to get big. They want to get like really famous. But realistically speaking, I don't think we're going to get like gigantic. And realistically speaking, I don't really want to be super famous. So I would like to be able to have a one-man live, like not part of like a giant group concert. I would like very much, this is my goal basically, I would like very much for us to be able to have enough fans to have a concert with just our fans and have everyone have a really good time, be like waving their little light sticks and shouting our names and stuff. That's my absolute goal for the future, for hopefully within this year, maybe next year. I would like that to happen. So at the moment, the steps that we're taking to achieve this is online, try and get as many people as possible to get enough like interest in us to maybe want to travel to Tokyo and see us. Maybe we can go to a different place. That would be cool as well. But yeah, the steps that we're going to take at the moment is basically online, YouTube as well. We're really trying hard with YouTube at the moment. And also we have one original song at the moment, but I would like an album.
So when you look back now on that decision that you made at December 31st, what do you think?
I'm glad I made the decision to put my foot forward and actually make moves. But at the same time, I did get my time wasted and had so much heartbreak and so much frustration in trying to go with these agencies, because I really did think it was the only way. If I could go back and tell myself, yo, go on Twitter and just start messaging people because you can do it yourself, like, I would have saved myself so many tears.
Yeah, but maybe you have saved someone else a lot of tears because they might listen to this.
I mean, that would be great. And they wouldn't get taken for a ride, because some of these agencies are sketchy and they try and, like, take money from you, that kind of stuff. Like, I mean, I wish that I had somebody to guide me through it and tell me which ones to stay away from.
Yeah, I can see that. I mean, that whole industry, the entertainment industry, I think in any country is always is a bit sketchy, you know, but...
Oh, yeah. It's a slump.
But I'm really glad to hear, though, that things, like, as a result of that negative experience, it sounds like you're in a much better space now, though, yeah?
Yes, exactly. I mean, if I hadn't gone through it and exhausted all of those avenues, then I wouldn't have tried a completely different thing, which is doing everything by myself.
Thanks to Alice for coming on the show. And if you want to check out more of her group, you can find them on Twitter and YouTube under the name Mai Doremi. And you know what? Actually, I think it's really great that she switched to this online format, because there's a lot of artists in Japan right now that are struggling because of the whole COVID situation. They can't actually perform. So many of them have tried to, like, switch online to try to, you know, still generate some kind of income from performing. But it's really tough to try to, you know, move your performance that you're normally performing in front of, like, a crowd of hundreds of people to suddenly online, right? So it's a big challenge right now. So if you're a fan of idols, go check them out on YouTube and on Twitter. And once everything gets lifted, go check out their concerts. Try to steal their fans from other idols, you know, and go to the handshake events and whatnot. Just don't be creepy, especially if you're a Tokyo Podcast audience member. Don't be creepy. You guys are all cool because you're, you know, you're Tokyo podcasters, so don't worry about it. But just go and be normal, and I'm sure Alice will love to see you guys there. So anyways, that wraps up this episode of the Tokyo Podcast. Thanks for listening, everybody. I'm your host, Anthony Joe, and talk to you next week. Bye-bye.